Madison. You are listening to the Perpetual Notion Machine. So, before we get into the show tonight, I just wanted to have a quick preface. So, in science, we always try to foster objective thinking to check our mental biases and logical fallacies at the door. Are we always successful in doing this? No, of course not. But we are rigid in our dedication to the cause of pure reason. Of course, it's impossible to separate politics from science because we live in a polarized world where all of creation can be viewed through a partisan lens. My hope is that during our time together in the show, through our chats, that we can all hear each other and understand each other's point of view of this world as science-prone human beings. In science, criticism is inevitable and necessary. Attacking the person behind the science while thought-provoking may not always be the best way to share factual information. At the end of the day, the scientific institution is made by humans, for humans, aiming to improve society as a whole. I value your opinions, and I hope that you'll find us on social media or send us an email at scienceonwart@gmail.com and share your thoughts. I'm happy to continue this conversation offline because we simply do not have time to cover everything that we would like to tonight. I'm making a conscious decision to use optimism today, and I hope you will too. And my views do not necessarily reflect everybody at PNM or Wart. A heart-rending tragedy has occurred, and nothing will ever change that. But tonight, I'd like to talk about how citizen science saved the city of Flint, Michigan. Through multi-level government dysfunction and incompetence, combined with neglected, decaying infrastructure, the citizens of Flint endured cruel and unusual treatment for years as their municipal water source was critically compromised by lead contamination and the spread of pathogenic bacteria. Yuck. Today, 6 long years since the crisis began, how has the situation in Flint changed? Although the solution to the problem seemed very simple in concept, untangling the web of vested interests that were preventing forward progress proved to be a more difficult challenge than anyone would have anticipated. Tonight, we are speaking with civil and environmental engineer Dr. Mark Edwards of Virginia Tech, an early scientific whistleblower who was instrumental in demonstrating that toxic levels of lead were present in Genesee County's water system. Although Dr. Edwards' contributions were fundamental in the fight to restore clean water to the citizens of Flint, lingering disorder stirred up during the controversy still hangs over the city. Does Flint finally have clean water? How can responsible citizen science enrich and protect our communities? How can Madison learn to manage its own critical water contamination issues, including PFAS leaching and agricultural runoff, to avoid another humanitarian crisis? To help us answer these questions and more, I'm happy to introduce my guest, Dr. Mark Edwards. Mark, how are you doing tonight?
Well, thank you for having me, and after that amazing introduction, I don't know what else is left to say.
So we'll wrap up a little early then. Thanks, everybody.
No, incredible.
We've got so much to talk about. So I think we're all dying to know, does Flint have clean water yet?
Well, let's start with the obvious, that there's no such thing as perfectly safe water. Even bottled water has risks. It has bacteria. It has plasticizers. But you know, in the grand context of risk, Flint is now in a range that's considered normal for other cities with old pipes. And in fact, the governor of the state of Michigan recently announced correctly that 70 cities have more lead in their water than Flint. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, Flint is still getting provided free lead filters as the result of the man-made disaster that occurred. And so mm-hmm. for folks using those filters, they are getting water cleaner than just about any city in America in the context of lead. But because of the vacuum of trust that occurred, the betrayal, the failure of government at all levels, many of my best friends in Flint, you know, just will never trust tap water again. Mm-hmm. They are still to this day not only drinking bottled water, but actually buying bottled water, heating it on a stove, and bathing in it. And so this is kind of like a loss of civilization as we know it, and that's the fate of what happens when people lose trust in government and in the systems that support our civilization.
Yeah. Yeah. And it a few weeks ago, we had an interview with a guest who had written a really interesting book about plagues through the ages. And it seems to me this is like another example of one of those plague fears and the psychology of illness and how that sort of directly contradicts scientific evidence, because humans are really complicated critters and our risk evaluation isn't always tuned like it should be. So I would definitely like to hear a little bit more about the story in Flint and kind of how we got to this point of the total breakdown of trust in governmental institutions and in rigorous academic research.
Well, to put it simply, about 2004, I think I was one of the first people to realize we lived in a post-truth society. And unfortunately, the post-truth was coming from science agencies. I witnessed the US EPA in Washington, D.C. and the US Centers for Disease Control fabricate scientific reports to cover up harm done from high lead in drinking water that was present there for 3 years. And it took me pretty near 8 years and about $1 million of my own money to expose that eventually in a bipartisan congressional investigation that said that, you know, this data was just made up, that it was scientifically indefensible. And at the time, I was just so outraged that these agencies that we pay to protect us would actually betray the public trust, that they would betray science in this way. And I, you know, at the time, I was just, the whole idea that this could happen, you know, what is to become of us if science is to become untrustworthy? What if the environmental policemen paid to protect us become environmental criminals? And, you know, that sort of set in motion a bizarre sort of crusade where I was predicting a Flint would happen. And I did that for about 10 years. And finally, you know, I connected with a mom who was from Flint, and she called me and told me what was going on. And she was working with an EPA employee, and it was the nightmare I always predicted coming true before my eyes. And thankfully, we prepared for the day, and the Flint residents were amazing in terms of helping to expose this. But, you know, this is now acknowledged to be one of the signature environmental injustices of our era, and rightly so. There was elevations in children's blood lead. There was law breaking. There were 12 deaths from Legionella. There were 15 civil servants indicted. The US EPA failed. The head of Region 5 resigned. And there was a federal emergency declared by President Obama. $600 million of relief flowed into Flint. And so, you know, this was really quite an event to be a part of and to help to expose.
Mm-hmm. So how did socioeconomic status complicate this drinking water crisis for you? And how did you, as a researcher, kind of engage with that issue?
Well, Flint was ahead of the curve in terms of going bankrupt. And there are literally thousands of cities following in their footsteps. And these are cities that are, you know, people are leaving. And they can't afford to maintain their infrastructure, much less improve it. They can't afford to meet federal law. And so we end up living a lie. We end up telling these folks, or their governments tell these folks, that their water is safe when it's not. And I feel that that's, you know, morally unconscionable. I would, you know, I'm very much a pragmatist. If we just want to tell people that they're on their own, that we'll get you water to your house, but it's not safe, and you have to treat it or boil it to make it safe, you know, that's just fine with me. If we're going to go all third world and roll that way, okay, but let's just be honest about it. But, you know, the alternative, and the only alternative, is for some of these cities like Flint that they need federal and state money in order to improve their infrastructure to the point they can meet federal law. So, you know, I've been watching this unfold for about a decade, and this is exactly what happened in Flint. And, you know, they cut corners to save a few pennies here and there. They ultimately decided to not follow federal corrosion control law. It wasn't to save money, by the way. Federal corrosion control law is actually the most cost-effective regulation we have. Each dollar you spend saves $10 in reduced damage to your pipes. It's like running your car with or without oil. You just don't do that. But, you know, when people are under financial stress, they make bad decisions, and this was certainly an epically bad decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because like I mentioned, I'm from Saginaw, Michigan, so I worry about how Saginaw is going to fare, you know, in the future. It's there's a lot of sadness accompanying these Rust Belt towns. You know, like there's this stigma, they're awful places to live, and why do people even stay there? Like, why don't they move out? But there's also, you know, this ruthless vitality to these places. There's art and culture and a self-reliant way of doing things. And I think that one way that citizens, regardless of their socioeconomic background, can engage and, you know, enact positive change, as a scientist myself, I think is through citizen science, by working with colleges or local community colleges to do these kinds of projects. So can you tell us a little bit about citizen science in Flint and how and what your experience was like, and if you've engaged in citizen science elsewhere, and kind of what that experience was like in comparison?
Sure. I grew up in one of those towns that was left behind, declining population, a one-room school, K through one-building school, K through 12, that's since closed. And, you know, I know the story. And, you know, I've always connected better with citizens due to the nature of my work. I've always done work in buildings and looked at the problems that people had from their water systems. And no one went there before. And I, from the start, I had to do citizen science to advance fundamental scientific understanding in terms of lead in water, copper in water, and opportunistic pathogens, because that's where they were growing.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes citizen science is the only way to solve problems. And the vast majority of my scientific breakthroughs came from talking to normal, you know, moms and dads, building operators, plumbers, speaking to them, helping them solve their problems sometimes, but synergistically also getting ideas that I could test in my lab.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a kind of ethnographic approach to research that I innovated by necessity. And, you know, most of my collaborators throughout the years have not been other academics.
Mm-hmm.
And so, too, in Flint. So when this mom called me, and she's an amazing woman, her name is Leanne Walter. She'd been working with an EPA scientist, Miguel Del Toro, who's like just happens to be the foremost expert on the lead and copper in the country and one of my best friends.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the three of us were working on this, and we knew this was it. This was ground zero. This is the day we were preparing for. This was EPA and the state EPA abdicating their responsibility, environmental policemen becoming environmental criminals. And so, you know, we tried to work within the system. We tried to get EPA to be the heroes. We had it all set up for that to happen. And then, unfortunately, the regional administrator at EPA came and snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. And Miguel was retaliated against. And then, you know, at that point, we sprang into notion. We launched Flint Water Study. We formed a collaboration with Flint residents. We called out the bad actors. And within 6 weeks of when we launched, this was front page on the New York Times. We showed there was a citywide lead problem. The citizens organized were, you know, just incredible. They got 300 bottles returned. They did an amazing job, and we were able to show that there was a real problem. And later we worked with a local pediatrician, Dr. Mona Hanna-Tisha, who showed that the blood lead was rising at that point. You know, the state and feds threw in the towel. They said there's a problem, and they started rolling up their sleeves to help. So it started out with an amazing triumph where we were at odds with the environmental policemen, called them out as environmental criminals, and then, but in October 2015, they admitted there was a problem, and they set about trying to help get it fixed.
Mm-hmm. So how is water testing being done in Flint, and kind of how have the results changed over time? And sort of specifically, if you could tell our listeners, how does lead get into water from lead pipings, and how does that affect drinking water and public health?
Well, lead's the best known environmental contaminant. The history goes back to 2,000 years. The Romans knew that lead exposure was bad. They knew that if you wanted to drink water, don't put it through a lead pipe. And unfortunately, we entered a dark age, lost that knowledge, and we started installing pipes all around the United States, and Flint was one of those cities that has a lot of lead pipes. And so, you know, unfortunately, what happened was in Flint, they forgot to use corrosion control when they made the switch over. Mm-hmm. I think it was innocent. When Leanne and Miguel first exposed this problem, before I even got involved, like, they should have admitted there was a problem, but unfortunately they started lying. It's always the case that the cover-up gets you. It's not the original crime. And the extent to which some of these so-called scientists and engineers work to cover up the problem really boggles the mind. They were like working overtime to make sure that people didn't know about the high lead. And that's really sad because, you know, it comes from your home plumbing. It comes from the lead service lines, which are pure lead pipes that connect your house to the water main. There's no lead up to the street in front of your house.
Oof.
But the main lead comes from a lead pipe that might connect your house to the water main, or lead solder, or lead in brass, lead in galvanized iron. And so you got to sample in people's houses to find it, and that's why this is such a tricky problem. Every house is different. Every plumbing system is different. You got to sample a lot of houses to really characterize the nature of the problem.
And still kind of run a standardized test between houses too, right?
Absolutely. You got to get statistical power. You have to try to get samples of water that's sat in the home plumbing and that's sat in the water main and that's sat in the lead service line. It's an incredibly challenging problem, and the team at Virginia Tech collaborated with this amazing citizen science team of about 12 people in Flint, and yeah, they were really the ones that helped expose this, and so it was an amazing team effort.
Mm-hmm. So over time and since then, so from what you had kind of said at the beginning of the show, good news, everybody, Flint's got clean water. They can drink it. They can bathe in it. There's just been kind of a public relations complication that seems to be ongoing in this perpetual distrust of institutions that are meant to kind of help people. Could you describe a little bit about the current conflict that's sort of going on amongst yourself and some activists in Flint?
Well, I mean, it starts out with the deserved loss of trust. There was no doubt this was a profound betrayal of government, a failure of government at all levels. And when that happens, how do you restore trust when it's lost so profoundly?
Mm-hmm.
We don't have an answer to that question. Even let's just look at the issue of lead in Flint water. There's not only the state required sampling that's being done, but EPA did their monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
Virginia Tech did citizen science monitoring. NRDC even hired a fourth and a fifth party to do lead monitoring. So you actually have five independent pieces of evidence now,
mm-hmm,
that lead in Flint water is now back to normal levels or even much, much better than other cities in Michigan. On top of that, you have the lead filters that are being distributed.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, with perhaps good reason, as a result of this disaster and betrayal of trust, many people will not trust the water, period, ever. And so, you know, when we started publishing data that the water was getting better, go figure, you have a federal emergency, you spend $100 million, FEMA's there, the best EPA engineers in the world are working on improving, mm-hmm, the water system, and finally it's getting better. I had to present data that after 14 months, the water's getting better. And incredibly, some activists started attacking me for claiming it was getting better. They actually went on and said the water's getting worse every day. And, you know, so it's fascinating to see this unfold. It's symptomatic of what's happening across our entire society, like a loss of trust that modern civilization runs on trust. What happens when trust is lost deservedly? Can you get it back? Who knows, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, they started calling me out. I don't really try to take it personally unless it gets personal. And unfortunately, some of them made it very personal, starting writing letters, saying things that I never said, that sort of stuff. But, you know, at the end of the day, perception is reality. Once people have lost trust, it, mm-hmm, doesn't matter what the data shows. You can't take it personally. Some of my best friends in Flint are never going to drink water in Flint. They move out of Flint. They're never going to drink tap water in any other city.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a fact, and I can't blame them for that, given their life's journey.
Right. Yeah, and I do want to point our listeners, too, towards a publication that you and Siddhartha Roy had published in Citizen Science, Theory and Practice. I believe this is an open source article.
Yes, yeah? Anyone can copy it, download it, send it all over the place. We paid money to make sure it got widely distributed.
Excellent. So this is it's a case study. It's called Citizen Science During the Flint, Michigan Federal Water Emergency, Ethical Dilemmas and Lessons Learned. And, whew, this goes places. This is a really, really fun, really fun read.
You could not make this stuff up.
I know. It's incredible, but it does, I mean, I appreciate your adherence to a strict citation in terms of some of the, like the Steve Harvey interviews that are cited. So it's like you can see a lot of awesome scientific rigor in this document, but at the same time, you know, like its application to citizen science, I think it's a really interesting read, and I would certainly encourage anybody to go through and kind of read this.
It's not a normal scientific paper.
No,
It's truth in all its soul-sickening, human nature.
It's one of those papers that I think a lot of us conventional academics really wish we could publish. You know,
I wish someone else had published it, not me, because
sure,
it was not pleasant to live through.
Goodness.
But anyway, yeah.
Sure, but that kind of hinges on this idea about inconvenient truths of science, which is sort of this ongoing theme, I think, in science and how science relates to government and to public health. I was wondering if you could kind of talk a little bit about that aspect, about how scientists are sort of viewed and how science is used in policy development and in public outreach.
Well, I mean, science is still the one institution that hasn't yet lost the public trust. Survey after survey has shown that. And that's something we have working in our favor, but we have to be very careful that we don't lose that trust. And my fear is that someday too many scientists will become unworthy, and then once we lose trust in science, what do we have left? We have total anarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people out there who, through either their philosophical point of view or through their life experience, have been burned and do not trust scientists. They think scientists are abusing power. They think that objectivity is a joke and that anyone who claims to be objective is trying to pull a fast one on them. And so, you know, this is something scientists guard again, because, you know, just because we can't be perfectly objective doesn't mean we shouldn't aspire to it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean we should, you know, pursue truth with humility. The only alternative is sort of the subjectivity free-for-all that we witness on our cable news and throughout our daily lives and the chaos that can result. So this is a kind of larger battle across society, like, you know, post-truth. What does this mean? If lying becomes the norm, you know, who do you trust? And again, I point out our entire modern civilization depends on trust in ways that we don't appreciate. Like, I mean, when we drive to work and we cross a bridge, we don't get out and inspect the bridge, you know, thinking that maybe it's not, you know, when someone knocks on our door, we trust that they're not going to harm us. Now, every now and then that proves to be false, but you can't live your life in fear.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do, all of civilization will collapse. So, you know, trust is just so important. Deserved trust and teaching scientists to be worthy of the public trust, that's what I'm living for.
Right. And one of the things that, as scientists ourselves, that a researcher, Dr. Dominic Broussard, who's at the University of Wisconsin, kind of tries to drive home in terms of scientific communication and outreach, is that it's not a matter of giving people facts. You know, like, you can dump all the facts you want onto somebody and it's not going to have the effect that we as academics tend to sort of expect. It's like, well, you understand now, right? You're convinced. But like you say, there's this all-important trust factor that we need to acknowledge in addition to our objectivity. So I think it's a really interesting debate that's going to continue going on. It's something we're all going to have to continue grappling with.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Day in and day out. That's an issue facing society right now.
Oh, yeah. I did want to briefly turn towards some of Madison's own kind of homegrown concerns about our water in the last 5 minutes or so that we've got left. So I sort of mentioned to you previously that Madison is concerned about PFAS leaching into certain wells, public wells, which are kind of at the time, right now, they're sort of confined to an army base or an ex-army base. And they think that that's sort of the foundation of that that contamination. We also have concerns about agricultural runoff in terms of bacterial and viral infectious agents, in terms of nitrates, things like that, things that can cause toxic algal blooms in our lakes. You know, Madison is completely surrounded by water, so we spend a lot of time thinking about our water. And one of the main concerns that I've kind of found is that people don't know what's safe. So like you say, nothing's ever truly safe. But state standards say one thing, federal standards can say another thing, activist groups can say something else. How do we kind of wrangle with this idea going forward to be our own best advocates for what is safe in our community?
Well, from the first perspective, we have to realize that life has probably never been better than it is right now technologically, and so too with drinking water. Probably fewer people die from drinking water present day than they ever have throughout history.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, we humans, we're great at screwing things up. We're always creating new problems. We're discovering new problems, and PFAS is amongst those. We're creating problems with road salt and agricultural runoff, and we're currently, you know, Madison's collecting data on this. It will be evaluated. It will be debated. There will be cost-benefit analysis. But, you know, I mean, let's keep things in perspective here, okay? We're not living in 100 years ago. We had the waterborne disease plagues that killed millions of people, you know, every year. And so these things are being studied. They're new. They're important. they should be debated, but realize we've got limited funds. We've got a lot of societal problems, and you got to have humility when you think about it, because if we spend too much money on lead and water or PFAS, we don't have money to fix our roads or run our schools.
Sure.
So I think that's part of the biggest problem as a scientist is, you know, you study one issue and you got to have humility and just go, you know, the grand scheme of all the things that threaten our civilization, how big a problem is it? I mean, I don't even feel lead is on the top 30 list. I mean, it's really annoying. For example,
sure.
we have a law in Flint that was broken. I mean, that's why I called that out. You'd think the debate's over, but, you know, at the same time, there's a lot of issues, and, you know, we're trying to do the best we can, and we don't always get it right. In fact, you know, we probably get it wrong more than we get it right, but we've made it so far. And so, you know, let's be as honest and truthful as we can, full of humility as we can, debate these issues. And everything you mentioned is worthy of debate. But overall, you know, water it's been a lot worse in the past.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like it's all good news, you know, and focusing on that topic of optimism. So just kind of to wrap up. One thing that people can do to sort of feel, I mean, because I feel like people might, you know, they feel powerless in the face of municipal water and fighting the government and not having the background or knowledge to understand the specifics of how this chemistry works to keep themselves safe. So there are a number of DIY fixes that people can utilize, too, if for nothing else and for safety or, you know, like peace of mind. Are there any filtration systems or things like that that you would recommend for people for cautious, you know, sort of use?
Sure. If you've studied this and this is something you're worried about and you want to get peace of mind, for example, for PFAS, you can go online and look up NSF protocol P473. That's NSF protocol P473. And you can buy filters that are designed to remove PFAS.
Oh, nice and easy.
You can buy filters designed to remove about anything that you want to. Now, whether that is worth your money, that's a personal choice. Mm-hmm. We make those kind of choices all day long. Some people choose to buy bottled water. Some people choose to buy filters. Some people choose to buy water from the tap. You know, overall, I think the normal regulations are relatively protective, but for those who want an extra margin of safety and do their homework, those things are available. And I think, you know, the main message here is let's please cultivate the scientist within all of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to be a truth seeker and truth speaker. And we live in such a tribal world, and you can live in fear. And I don't think that's the way to go.
Thank you so much, Mark. This has been so uplifting. I'm so grateful for you coming and jumping on the show with us. Is there anything you'd like to, any additional advice you'd like to leave people with?
No.
Or any websites you'd like to point them to? Anything you'd like to shout out?
FlintWaterStudy.org. If you want to learn about the Flint water crisis and the fight over citizen science, and you can't make this stuff up.
Dr. Mark, thank you so much. We're going to keep it positive in 2019. Thank you again for joining us. This has been the Perpetual Notion Machine. Thank you.
Take care.